He turned easily, mouth bones wreathed in a smile behind the faceplate.
"Want to try?"
said Turl, pretending to hand over the gun. Johnny reached for it. Turl laughed an enormous laugh and put it back in his belt. Johnny had long since been waiting for Turl. From the moment Turl had started on this route from the city, he had known Turl would call here, and he had flown down from the mine. It had seemed better not to let Turl know he was under observation, and he had intended to delay a bit longer. But the screaming of the tortured horses had sickened him. This was a much changed Turl, very like his old self.
"Let's walk," said Turl.
With a signal of the hand that Turl did not see, an angry Johnny sent a Scot to slit the throats of the tortured, maimed horses and put them out of their misery. He steered Turl around the corner of a building to block his view of the action.
"Well, animal," said Turl, "I see you are getting along just fine. I suppose you're trying for a second pocket."
"Yes," said Johnny, controlling his anger. "We don't have quite enough gold yet."
That was an understatement.
All the gold they had he was carrying in a bag right this minute.
"Fine, fine," said Turl. "Need any equipment? Any supplies? Just say the word. Got a list with you?"
Johnny didn't.
"No? Well, all you have to do is put a list in those bundles you keep leaving outside the cage, and I'll just have them run right over to you. Label it training supplies, of course."
"Fine," said Johnny.
"And if you want to talk to me, just flash a light through the glass at my quarters. 3 short flashes and I'll come out and we can talk. Right?"
Johnny said that was fine. There were some mining points that came up every now and then.
"Well, you just ask the right party," said Turl, patting himself on the chest. "What I don't know about mining has never been written up."
He laughed loudly. Indeed, this was a different Turl, thought Johnny. Something had taken the pressure off him. They were still out in a field and hidden from view by a knoll.
"Now, to business," said Turl. "On day 89, you are to deliver my gold to this building in the old city up there."
He took a picture out of his pocket and showed it to Johnny. It said on the building, "United States Mint." Johnny started to take it, but Turl pulled it back and showed him 3 other views. The street, the building from 2 sides.
"Day 89, said Turl, 2 hours after sunset. "Don't be seen. There's a room I fixed up. Put it in there."
Johnny studied the views. Obviously, Turl was not going to give him the physical possession of them. There were some mounds he knew were old cars, and back of the building was a bigger mound, probably a truck. The doors of the place were sound and closed, but undoubtedly Turl had them unlocked.
"Have you got a flatbed ground truck?" asked Turl. "No, I'll give you one."
He became impressive, commanding.
"Now listen carefully. You and 2 other animals, no more, are to arrive at that exact time. You, personally. Tell the others you won't return until day 93, and you'll bring them their pay. From day 89 to 93, I have some other things for you to do. Understand? You, personally, and 2 animals. No more. The rest stay at the mine. Right?"
Johnny said that was understood. They were standing well screened from any view behind some bushes. "Do you want to see a sample of what was hauled up?"
Yes, Turl certainly did.
So Johnny threw down a piece of heavy cloth and spilled wire gold onto it. It glowed softly in the sunlight. Turl glanced up to be sure there was no overhead surveillance, and then hunkered down. He fondled the nets of gold, some of the quartz still sticking to it. He spent some time at it and then stood up with a paw signal to put it away. Johnny did so, carefully. It was all they had. Gazing at the bag, Turl let out a long sigh into his breath mask.
"Beautiful," he said. "Beautiful."
He came out of it.
"So, on day 89, I get a ton of gold, right? He patted his pocket where the remote control lay. And then on day 93, you get your payoff.
Why the delay? Said Johnny. That's 4 days.
Oh, you've got a few things to do, said Turl. But never fear, animal. Come day 93, you will be paid off, with interest. Compounded. I promise you very faithfully.
He laughed a huge guffaw into his mask, and Johnny knew that Turl might be feeling high today, but he was not entirely sane.
You'll get everything that's coming to you, animal, said Turl. Let's walk back to the car.
Never in his whole life had Turl felt so good. He recalled from the Scotland trip how eager they were for pay. This animal was going to get paid on day 89. Then he could kill the females. With no fear of psychic powers.
Delicious. Goodbye, animal,
he said, and drove off in great spirits. 6. The next weeks were filled with tension. They were driving along the vein in hopes of a second pocket, but as yet saw only white quartz, no gold. And without gold, nothing else was going to work. The incident of the horse herd caused an uproar among them. They had trained those horses, and they had become pets, left at the academy where there was grazing, waiting for better days. The Scots were outraged. Not only because of the loss, but because of the sickening way it had been done. It brought home to all of them the nature of the enemy. Were all cyclos like that?
Yes, unfortunately.
Lookouts had spotted other crippled animals around the compound. Didn't this put the girls in great danger?
Yes, but one had to grit one's teeth and make sure their plan came off on schedule. By all that was holy, they mustn't muff a single thing.
It was like playing a violent kind of chess with maniacs. In other areas than the gold, they were making progress. Angus had made keys to everything in sight. It was very risky. Heat-shielded bodies, silent feet in the snow of night, impressions in wax, dusted over tracks. There was double jeopardy in this, for any discovery might not only cost the man his life, but also alert the cyclos that something was intended. They had a good break in studying the old battle of 1,000 years ago. The records were all in order now, all satellite overviews of it in sequence. Johnny and Dr. McDermott had been going over them, looking for something that might help. There were numerous reports on the battle planes in that one-sided struggle. An oddity was that a cyclo battle plane had dive-bombed a tank in downtown Denver. But there was no tank detailed to downtown Denver, according to U.S. Army statements on it. This attracted Johnny's attention and led him to discover a second report on the same plane. After bombing the tank that the report said was not there, the battle plane took off at high speed to the northwest and was sighted colliding with a snow-covered mountainside. It didn't explode. The spotting gave the exact position. They looked it up on their maps. It was only about 300 miles to the north of them. Dunnell Dean verified it with an overfly and metal detector, and the battle plane was still there, buried, all but the tip of its tail, in perpetual snows. Using 2 flying ore platforms, they dug it out and airlifted it at night, to avoid detection, to the old base, and there, in the heliport, subjected it to minute study. The battle plane was unserviceable, but it contained a host of information that could not be gained by a stealthy scout to the compound. The 2 cyclo pilots had been killed on impact, but their equipment, though decayed, was intact. They went over every detail of the breathe masks. They found there was a compartment that contained jet-driven backpacks as a form of parachute in case of necessary bailout. The security belts were no different from those used in the mine vehicles. The pilots also wore belt guns. The controls of the plane were identical to the passenger mining ships. The only additions were the gun triggers and switches for a magnetic grappler. Examining the skids on which the plane stood, they found, indeed, that they were electromagnetic. The plane could be fixed with this to any metal surface, and obviated the necessity of tying it down. They also located the key slots and determined the type of keys. They cleaned it up as best they could and used it for drilling their pilots. The dead, mummified cyclos were dissected by the parson to ascertain where their vital organs were located. Their hearts were in back of their belt buckles, and their lungs were high in their shoulders. Their brains were very low in the back of the head, and the rest of the head was bone. The parson then buried them with proper solemnity. They were busy on many projects. They built a large-scale model of the compound in the huge loft of the Empire Dauntless Mining Building and drilled every team member. They marked out approximate distances in a meadow, without betraying anything to a drone, and timed everything. How fast did one have to go to get from this place to that? What were the starting times from zero time in order to converge simultaneously? There was much information they did not have and could not get, so they made up for it with flexibility. A problem they had to solve was replacing the horses. By rounding up and training wild ones, and working very fast, a small group was able to do this. They had all become excellent marksmen with the assault rifles and bazookas. With the relentless drilling by Robert the Fox, that past master of raids, they were really getting someplace. "If we miss," Robert the Fox repeatedly told them, "and slip up on the tiniest detail, those planes out there will once again be crawling with transshipped cyclo tanks and the sky studded with battle planes. The home planet of the cyclos would retaliate with ferocity. We would have no course open save to withdraw into the old military base and probably perish of asphyxiation when they resort to gas. We have one thin chance. We must not miss in any tiniest detail. Let's go through it all again." A strike force of only 60 men taking on the whole Cyclo Empire? They would harden their determination and go through the drill again, and again, and again. But they did not yet have the vital, crucial chip, the goal.